We are the music makers, and we are the dreamers of dreams.
Television is reality, and reality is less than television.
All necessities provided, all anxieties tranquilized, all boredom amused.
Ladies and gentlemen, DRS Theaters are proud to welcome you. Please, silence your cell phones. Remember, no outside food or drink or Negroes allowed in the theater during the program. Thank you. And now, our feature presentation, The Pause Button, with your host, Borzoi Boskovich.
Borzoi, you're going to have to speak up.
All right. We'll start in a second here, guys. I just want to collect everything here. Okay. The worst thing about this modern world is that people think you get killed on television with zero pain and zero blood. It must enter into kids' heads that it's not very messy to kill somebody and it doesn't hurt that much. That's a real sickness to me. That's a real sick thing. And welcome to the pause button. I'm your host, Borzoi. And this is, guys,
I did it. Episode 100. This is episode 100. It's a very auspicious film that we're doing this on, and I have my two favorite people to do pause button with. I'm very excited. I got Titus from Tales from the Trough.
Yes.
Maybe you're more well known now for posting big titty elf waifus on Twitter.
I perfected my art form. Yes, thank you. Yeah. Good to be here, boys. So congratulations on 100 episodes. It's amazing.
Thank you. Go follow him on Here Lies Thighs. And of course, the inimitable, the legendary Nick Mason from Myth of the 20th Century.
Happy to be in the Paz Lodge, Borzoi.
Yeah, are you recording this one from Taco Bell this time, Nick?
Nah, I'm outside of an enemy coffee shop that's been shut down due to the plague, and I'm poaching their Wi-Fi. Amazing.
Never change, Nick. Where can people find your stuff, Nick?
I am where I always am, but I am back on Twitter. I have a new handle. You can post it with the you can tag me.
Sure.
And you post this on Twitter, whatever, it's fine.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, I got shut down.
In Myth of 20th Century, tell me what your guys, what is it, just mythofthe20thcentury.com?
Yeah, we have a .com.
Oh yeah, here it is, myth20c.wordpress.com. That's what it is. And of course, go read The American Sun. If people aren't aware of this, theamericansun.com was started by the Myth of 20th Century guys. So, Nick, you're still your title there is editor?
Yes, editor-in-chief. I have been out of production for a little bit, but I'm hoping to get back into it.
Okay, so we'll just say editor, because I wasn't sure if you were the editor-in-chief or not. But or is that Ryan? It's probably Ryan. He's the editor-in-chief. But anyways, that's enough of that. We're talking about Mulholland Drive. Yes, this is a donation episode, and I was very excited to do this one because I guess we'll just start with the first question. Why David Lynch? What is it about him that makes his films his and why are they worth watching? Because when people think of David Lynch, I imagine that scene from The Simpsons where they're watching Twin Peaks, and it shows is like a man dancing with a unicorn under the moonlight as jazz music plays. That's what I think of when I think of David Lynch. So why David Lynch?
Why not David Lynch? I think would be the better question. But I think David Lynch, and I can only speak personally, but like David Lynch, I think, is probably America's greatest filmmaker and one of America's greatest artists. And by greatest artists, I'm like including Hawthorne and Melville and McCarthy. I think he's that important and he's that good. Not a coincidence. I also think his taste and sort of philosophy and worldview are very much aligned to people on sort of the dissident right of things. He certainly has that milieu. He certainly has that sort of aesthetic. And if you parse sort of the things that he's said in his personal life or the things regarding issues, he's very much aligned and shares, you know, many of the things that we believe and care about.
Yeah, when an artist has a nuanced take on Trump, I know that they're real, that they have actually something worth saying, and it's probably something that should be paid attention to.
Yeah, and again, like I don't want to like just sort of like pigeonhole him because like, and sort of what like what you said with like the Simpsons sort of, oh, like this is David Lynch, like it's such a like I actually kind of like get offended by that sort of like the idea of like the Lynchian trope, because there are tropes with Lynch. He does work within a very specific framework, but it conveys a very, very strict and a very defined meaning. So if you ever watch anything by David Lynch, you will come across two very tangible sort of emotive drives in every work that he's done. The first and foremost, and perhaps like the most jarring, is his like very lighthearted, if not like overly sugary sense of like humor. It's very corny. It's very out of place. It's almost a little bit jarring. And the second thing, and certainly the most expressive and certainly the most noticeable, is abject terror, horror, and trauma. And it's the combination of those two things.
Yeah, that quote I opened up with was a quote from him from an article that was written about him in New York Times Magazine back in 1990, Dark Lens on America, when he was talking about that kids think people get killed on television with zero pain and zero blood. So trauma is very at the core of a lot of what Lynch is saying.
And he said that while he was doing Twin Peaks, which is a very that's not a coincidence. Twin Peaks is all about trauma and death of fictional persons. So yeah, I'm just gonna like fanboy now. So I'm gonna pass it to you guys.
Yeah, Nick, do you have any thoughts on that that conversation?
Yeah, I agree with Titus as far as I think that Lynch is probably one of America's greatest filmmakers. I mean, he's one of the few to rival the European greats in that he goes up to the level of, you know, the Bergmans and the Hitchcocks. In fact, Hitchcock is, you can see a lot of Hitchcock in Lynch. But he's, in many ways, he's basically a magician. You know, I mean, for Lynch is sort of a mysticism that he, I mean, you can't really look at one of Lynch's films independent of the others. They all overlap with themselves. I mean, we're talking, I only recently watched the Twin Peaks return. And when I was reading a little bit about it, I found out that apparently the Audrey Horne character in Twin Peaks was going to be the character in a TV spinoff called Mulholland Drive.
Yep.
And you see, you know, the reuse of actors and actresses as well as, I mean, Anglo Baldamenti for soundtrack, who also Mulholland Drive plays the man drinking the espresso. The use of Roy Orbison, you know, the sort of the pivotal scene in Mulholland Drive uses the Roy Orbison cover, and he brings back Rebecca Del Rio later in The Return. I mean, his movies all, they, you have the same kind of themes. Usually there's some kind of interdimensional demon that preys off of beauty.
Yeah, I kind of consider Roy Orbison like one of the quintessential filmmaker, or not filmmaker, musician of the 20th century. There's a very American, it's a funny thing where it's hard to define sometimes what we say, what we mean when we say, like, oh, that's very American. There's some qualities you can define, but like Roy Orbison like, has a very visceral and oral American quality to him that I think just it transcends a bit more than some American musicians do. I don't know if you guys kind of would agree or disagree with that.
I think it's well known as well at this point that what happened with Twin Peaks was that it was only the first stage of what Lynch was trying to do was revive an ancient Aryan mystery religion, and that's why Bob Iger shut it down.
please do go on.
What do you mean?
Can you elaborate a little bit more on that?
Do you want the pause button to get shut down by Bob Iger, Borzoi? Think for a moment. This man's very powerful. On your 100th episode? Come on, buddy. You got to be a little bit more cautious than that.
I think that that's the way to go out, wouldn't it?
Yes.
Maybe I'll record Nick explaining and then just cut it off like right at the start. So to keep it a mystery, just tease people with it.
And it's true I definitely wouldn't call him tropes, but he has his techniques. Some are borrowed, some are his own. But he has a remarkable ability to take very mundane things and imbue them with a very sinister and mysterious aura. I don't know if you've ever seen, he did public health video. He did an anti-littering video. It's like 2 minutes long or something. It's almost like a parody of his own work. It shows like someone throw a candy wrapper or something in a gutter in New York City.
Yeah, here from 1991 right here.
Yeah, and then it shows just like the rats. And it's worth watching. I mean, he uses these same techniques and he bounces between, as Titus was saying, he bounces between, you know, something innocent. Then all of a sudden you wonder, is it so innocent?
I know you've called Wild at Heart like the great American film or like the greatest American film because of both the content in it. It's a Lynch film and with Nicolas Cage, whom I know you've been like one of the biggest Nick Cage defenders on.
Greatest actor of his generation, hands down.
Wild at Heart is my personal favorite Lynch film, but I think Mulholland Drive is his best film.
Yeah.
All right, let's get into Mulholland Drive proper then.
Well, I just want to stress to like the people who are listening, like, don't listen to this and then watch the movie. If you haven't seen the movie, watch the movie. Like this is like, you know, like listening to people like talking about Mozart without seeing Mozart or without hearing Mozart. Like this is sort of like, this is something that like you as like just a person stuck on Hell World, like you need to like watch and experience like this movie.
That's right.
Unfiltered and sort of unmolested by the likes of us. So yeah,
the reason why I wanted to kick off this discussion by talking about David Lynch first is because you said something that was very interesting to me. And I don't think you need to elaborate on it too much. I think it speaks for itself. But you said that David Lynch's films are very emotive, and you referred to this film as being very emotive, which I get. I think that's what makes me like uneasy sometimes when I watch a Lynch film, and why I have trouble kind of describing what I'm seeing. It goes to that trauma you're seeing, like you're seeing a very emotive trauma that's playing out on the screen, and it can be a little bit hard to contextualize that.
Yeah, and it also like it's also very hard, like with Lynch specifically, like the only thing that really genuinely matters are sort of like the themes and sort of the sort of illusory sort of aspects that he's playing with. And Mulholland Drive is a great example of this, because like the plot, the plot is boring in its own way, like or rather it's specifically crafted to be hokey and sort of nonsensical and weird. And then of course there's the the turn that happens, but like just sort of doing like a very standard sort of like plot outline of this character doing this and the sort of, you know, character progression and all this stuff like that, like that's not the proper way of viewing and sort of understanding this film. And I would of course argue all of David Lynch's films. You have to approach it from a very different angle.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. The plot itself is, I mean, people have argued over this movie since it came out, mm-hmm. but the plot is ultimately, and I will spoil it. So as Titus said, if you haven't seen it, go watch the movie, but
yes.
the plot is yeah. effectively, you know, small town girl goes to Hollywood city, you know, the city of dreams, city of angels, and wants to become an actress, but ends up a drug addicted whore who blows her brains out.
Yeah. And it turned her yes. gay as well.
Yeah, that's when you get into the nuances of the plot as to what is illusion and what is reality, that's another story. But yeah. that I think that's the basic thing that can be agreed on.
Yeah.
Whether or not, you know, the lesbo stuff was exactly real or not, or whether it was a projection of her narcissism.
Or if Lynch is actually portraying the lesbo stuff accurately, in that lesbianism is a product of abuse, and Diane was abused, and that's why she became a lesbian.
Yeah, like that's most certainly lesbians. Yeah, that's certainly like how like that. I when I was watching this, this was the first time I'd ever seen it. I was like, this is. I wonder if this movie got a lot of flack because of the themes of obsession. You got like the psycho stalker lesbian element of it, which is a common trope that they constantly complain about, and because this movie is so suffused with abuse and trauma in its film language that I just wonder if it like I had wondered if this had gotten a lot of flack for portraying lesbian relationship in that way, but I guess that wouldn't surprise me as well that they saw it as a positive depiction because they didn't pick up on that.
Well, because it wasn't like from like the male gaze, which is like the reason why he got all the hate for Blue Velvet, because like yeah. that abuse was like yeah. male centric and male dominant.
I'm surprised you haven't seen it before, boys, because it is one of those movies that you go back and watch again over the years and you come away with a little something else. Mm-hmm. As to the lesbian stalker comment, that is open for interpretation. As to, for example, who is she stalking? Who is she obsessed with? What is the reason that she has this woman killed? You have the scene where she goes into the audition and she sees Justin Theroux.
Yeah.
You don't know what might have taken place between them. I think it's not necessarily a lesbian obsession that's going on there. It's the
jealousy over Adam.
Or yeah, jealousy over a self, an yeah. image and a reality of self, namely the successful actress, that she manages to put all of these things in her psyche. And has its own, you know, has its own dream logic with the, you start to slowly see the reveal of things that were once, you know, taken as, you had a cowboy, for example, you had a name, and then you see the name of a waitress, or you see a man with a cowboy hat, and you see these things reassembled. One thing that I did not catch when I had watched it previously, but caught when I rewatched it, was that Justin Theroux is not the director of the film that she didn't get the part in.
Oh, I've never caught that. What is he?
Yeah, so when they're at the announcement party, you know, whatever is to be announced, probably engagement or whatever, you never find out though what's to be announced. She's asked how it is that she met, you know, Camilla, and her response was that, well, she met her on the set for the film, and they're like, oh, so and so got such a part, and then they mention the name of the director, which is not the name of Justin Theroux's character, Adam.
No, I think that's a different movie, though.
Yeah,
it's the same movie that she auditions for within The Dream. Yeah, but like that director, like the sort of imbecile director within that dream is not Adam, but Adam is another director, though.
Oh, I think that's what Nick is saying, that the directors yes. are different, that even though like we have the same character later, like because it establishes that difference between the two realities that are going on, since it's questionable which reality is the real one,
No. So, all right. And this is just sort of like explaining to like the listener, because this is just going to get thoroughly convoluted. two thirds, I mean, sort of the running. And again, like, this is actually something that we can sort of, I'm going to table this for a moment, because like the idea of Lynch and sort of like the multiple meanings of Lynch's films. And like, I actually have like a very specific thing about that, but sort of the, sort of a accepted sort of a view of this movie is that the beginning two thirds of this film are a dream. They're basically a death fantasia of the main character. So, but in terms of I think it's called the Sylvia North story, like that director Bob Brooker is the director in the dream and in reality.
Oh,
Adam's,
yeah.
Adam's a totally different director. And the scene where Diane is watches Camilla sort of seduce Adam, that isn't the Sylvia North story. That's a different story. That's what I've always viewed it as.
Yeah. All right.
What does the cast, when she's taken by the casting agents to the film that Justin Theroux is making, mm-hmm. what does she say about the film?
It doesn't, they don't give it a name, but it's not the Sylvia North story, because the scene right before that, when she's doing the audition with like the slimy grease ball, that's the Sylvia North story. They're two separate projects.
But I pulled up the Sylvia North story on the Mulholland Drive website that delves into a lot of this. It says, why does Adam in place of Bob Brooker direct the Sylvia North story in Diane's Dream? So the Sylvia North story did have two different directors.
Yeah.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
Oh. I guess
I'll just read what it says here. What we deal here with is a shift of identities. Reality, Diane and Camilla met on the Sylvia North story directed by Bob Brooker. Camilla got the lead and played off well, while Diane was rejected for apparent lack of talent. Camilla and Diane became friends / lovers since Camilla managed to now. Camilla's latest picture, the title is never mentioned, was directed by Adam Kircher, also featuring Diane in a minor role. Camilla and the director fell in love. And at the film's wrap-up party, they announced their engagement. Dream. In Diane's dream, identities got twisted up. Bob Brooker, an acclaimed director, whose film The Sylvia North Story can certainly be called a masterpiece, is now miming a hapless and inept third-rate director whose flicks don't even make it to the big screen. He only speaks when prompted and fails to recognize the great talent of Betty where everyone else thinks she's got star power. This is Diane's way of expressing her dislike for how Brooker once spoiled her career.
Yes, yes, yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
Bob's real life partner as the director of the Sylvia North story is now played by Adam Kircher. Diane dooms him for intruding into her affairs of Camilla, so she lets him experience her own downward path in Hollywood, which essentially incorporates being cheated, losing control, going broke. This way, Diane obtains gratification for Adam stealing away Camilla and leaving her life in a mess.
And the character, and Justin Theroux's character, he's basically. We have is the psychological cope going on as to why Camilla is chosen, right?
Yes.
In a dream logic, where it's that there are powerful forces behind the scenes that control Hollywood and have decided that this woman must do this. And then in being forced to do that, the director is also punished, you know, his life is punished. So it explains why she would not be chosen, because there are powerful forces that did.
There's a conspiracy against her.
Yeah, again, a conspiracy against her.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Sorry, I was looking at a because when we were started on the whole thing about the idea of lesbianism and the difference of with it not involving the male gaze, I actually was looking at this journal article called Spectacular Failure, the Figure of the Lesbian in Mulholland Drive. I was just looking to see if there's any kind of choice quotes I could pull from that. But
the thing about in Lynch films, you have one recurring theme is that you have illusion is reality and reality mm-hmm. is illusion.
And very, very relevant to the pause button, actually.
Well, yeah, this is so the thing about the cabal that controls Hollywood. Well, in a, this is an illusion in the sense that this is the product of a fractured suicidal psyche. But at the same time, it's true. A dark cabal does control Hollywood, and bodies really are dumped in places like Mulholland Drive.
Yeah.
And he plays with this a lot. I mean, what's one of the first scenes in the movie? What I think one of the most memorable scenes at the Winklers.
Yes. Or Winklers. Dream. Yeah.
Yeah. So what happens in that scene? You have a man telling another man about a dream, and he goes outside to find that the dream is reality, and he's just been killed by a dream.
Yeah.
I mean, if you can sum up the movie in a certain sense, it's that dreams can kill. You have the illusion of the glamour that is projected by Hollywood that draws in these young girls from small towns and chews them up and eats their soul, feeds them to diabolical Jews.
Yeah, that's sort of my sort of overarching like take of this as well. And that, and it is like, it's not, again, you have to like this, like all of David Lynch's films, it's exceptionally deliberate. Everything is deliberate. And it isn't a coincidence that a movie about Hollywood, 2/3 of that movie within the movie aren't real. So it's all about sort of the illusory of narrative. It's the illusory of the Hollywood sort of system, and it's the illusory nature of like cinema as an art form, because it's telling you stories that are fiction while at the same time potentially having some sort of deeper and more insidious truth to them.
Speaking of the idea of and I agree with that completely, speaking of the idea of kind of lesbianism in dreams, well, first I'll read this, because this actually was an interesting thing from that article, Spectacular Failure, which is by Heather K. Love. So David Lynch's 2001 film Mulholland Drive takes up several of the most powerful and persistent images of the lesbian. That Lynch had hit a vein was clear from the inordinately enthusiastic reviews that appeared in mainstream media and on the internet. Reviewers rhapsodized in particular and at length about the film's sex scenes, as if there were a contest to see who could enjoy this representation of female same-sex desire the most. However, I happened to talk to several people who told me that they were disturbed by Lynch's representation of lesbians as objects of male fantasy. These well-meaning viewers expected to find a sympathetic audience in me as a lesbian, as someone who works on lesbian representation. I was irritated by this assumption and found myself perversely defending male fantasy. Hundreds of years of experience have gone into making those fantasies. Those are quality fantasies. Of course, these viewers were in one sense right. Mulholland Drive is awash in male fantasy. This in itself is not so shocking, though, since we find traces of such fantasies in any representation of lesbianism, and in real life as well. Given that the lesbian is so overwritten by cliché, the central criterion for judging lesbian representation tends to be whether it challenges reigning clichés of the lesbian or capitulates to them. Lynch is not interested in challenging lesbian clichés. Instead, he works almost exclusively through such clichés, exploring both the sweeping vistas and the back alleys of this stereotyped world. Now, where it got interesting is where she then kind of talks about this, the dream aspect of it right here. In Mulholland Drive, Lynch draws on not one lesbian cliche, but two, as he juxtaposes the two most familiar lesbian plots of the 20th century. In the romance between Betty and Rita, Lynch presents lesbianism in its innocent and expansive form. Lesbian desire appears as one big adventure, an entree into a glamorous and unknown territory. This fantasy both compensates for and functions as a screen for the story's other lesbian narrative. In the story of Diane and Camilla, Lynch offers us a classic lesbian triangle in which an attractive but unavailable woman dumps a less attractive woman who is figured as exclusively lesbian. Just as it is necessary that there should be no man in the first positive scenario, it is crucial that the betrayal in the second story should come in the form of the inaccessible woman's ending up with a man. Within such a narrative, the woman who discards a woman for a man stands in for the glamour of mobile desire, while the committed lesbian represents the horror of a fixed but impossible object choice. The continuing resonance of this plot of triangulation is legible in the fact... Oh, this wasn't even the quote I was looking for, but this was interesting anyways. In the fact that lesbianism is popularly understood as both the hottest thing on earth and at the same time as something fundamentally sad and not at all erotic. The lesbian is at once the sexiest possible woman and at the same time an abject and unwanted creature. Just as the innocent schoolgirl plot floats magnificently free of the imperatives of the phallus, reproduction and social reality itself, so in the classic lesbian triangle, the heterosexual order asserts itself of crushing effects for the abandoned woman.
This is the ravings of a mentally ill female. It's funny. It's funny. She's this stupid hole doesn't understand that the like what she talked about is like the rosy sort of fantasy of lesbianism is in the movie a fucking fantasy, and the reality is just nothing but like abuse and pure sort of, I mean, from you know, at least sort of within sort of like the non sort of fantasy element of Mulholland Drive. Yes, like Diane, like, is obviously very clearly a very troubled and like evil woman, but like Camilla, like Rhodes, is equally just sort of from the few scenes that you see of her. Like, she's not like she doesn't come across as a good person either. They're both genuinely terrible people, which again is sort of like a running theme of David Lynch's you know, sort of oeuvre, where like it's a case study on like people who are, you know, not good, and bad things happen to them.
Yeah, I would definitely object to the idea that it is a male fantasy. If anything,
yes,
what's being portrayed is a female fantasy.
Yes,
because what you have is a woman who makes serious mistakes and constructs an elaborate fantasy world to shield herself from taking responsibility for anything that's happened to her that she's done. That's the entire psychic aspect of the film, albeit she is still a victim in the first place. But what's going on is that, yes,
you could analyze that as the quintessential female fantasy then of being a victim. Yes.
Yeah, and I would also reject that there's any that it's real lesbianism as the you know, the credentialed dykes would have it. It's not that. It's some weird psychosexual narcissism going on. Yeah. For example, when the lesbian scene takes place, what just occurred? She's beginning the process of transforming herself into looking like Naomi Watts' character.
Yes, yes, yes.
I actually asked a woman who had a bisexual lesbian past or whatever, because I was kind of interested in like, what's the eroticism of that sex scene exactly?
It's for research.
Well. Well,
I'm doing a show on Mulholland Drive.
she knows who I am. So like she legitimately did know like what I was doing this for. But I asked her about that, and she says, when Betty tells her I'm in love with you, that is actually what turns me on more. In female porn, marriage is the money shot. I found that to be a very interesting insight. I don't know if that's something you guys would agree with, but I wanted to at least get a woman's perspective on that scene in particular, and that's what she told me.
When Betty
tells Rita, I'm in love with you, that is, and this is in the sex scene, that is actually what turns me on more. In female porn, marriage is the money shot. I thought that to be a very interesting thing that she told me. I don't know if you guys give that any weight or not.
Was that Rita's response?
No, I think Betty
says.
Was that wait? Because again, and this is another thing with like in terms of like again like the male gaze. Because like both lesbian sex scenes they're both fantasies, like within like the nature of the film.
Yeah, the first like one sort of in the dream.
The first one's in the dream, but the second one that takes place when Diane is on the couch is also a fantasy. Like whether or not it's she could be remembering sort of a past sort of liaison, but like she's on the couch alone masturbating and like she envisions Camilla's back and you know they start getting at it. But
why is she masturbating? Is this some kind of weird lesbian trip she's on, or is it back to my claim, which is
psychosexual
self-obsession type thing going on.
Yeah, that's a really decent point. It's a really good point.
Yeah, I agree with that. Yeah, it was just like it was in that first sex scene, the one that's meant to be portrayed as much more romantic. She was just explaining to me that, like, what's the money shot for women is I'm in love with you. Like, marriage is the money shot, she explained to me.
This is the, I forget the term in stage magic, but in film, it's just, or narrative storytelling, they're red herrings. Or in this case, with lesbianism, I mean, what better way to sort of distract the viewer than getting the Naomi Watson, the former wife of Otto von Bismarck's great-grandchild. I forget her name, but she has a royal title. She was like the first wife. You know, they show bobs.
Yeah.
Okay. And this is what distracts. I mean, it's like in Blue Velvet, for example, you had a similar thing going on. I mean, he uses a lot of the same motifs. I mean, both these characters have two names. I mean, in Twin Peaks, you had Laura Palmer has her double. Lost mm-hmm. Highway is another doppelganger.
Yeah.
And he's using, I mean, this is something he definitely owes to Hitch. I mean, a lot of these have, he uses techniques that Hitchcock used in Vertigo. Mm-hmm. Blue Velvet, he uses techniques that Hitchcock used in Psycho, but he makes them his own, respectably.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sorry, I was looking at the, on the Mulholland-Drive.net website about the themes of sexual abuse, and they list a lot of different things that, that point to the idea of sexual abuse within the movie.
Yes, that's a huge thing. And a big sort of tell is the scene with the fake Camilla Rhodes and sort of how she's sort of introduced and sort of that, like, she has, like, she gives, like, the look of someone who is, like, very much sort of on edge and very, very nervous. So, like, that she's been, like, yes, she's been sort of picked by the sort of shadowy mafia of Hollywood, but at the same time, she's also been abused by them.
Well, they listed some very interesting indicators of this stuff that I would have never have picked up on. So at the airport, we hear the old lady saying, "It's been so nice traveling with you," but as Betty's arriving for her new life, she parts with them there. Betty/Diane sees them leaving in the limo, but with very menacing looks on their faces, suggesting that even though she has left them behind, they're still looking out there as a possible menace in ways of memories of her sexual abuse. That's actually a good way of you can kind of see, like, the idea of, like, of somebody older, like, abusing somebody younger, that with having it be these much more elderly people, and you're not sure why they're there, but they loom throughout the entire movie only to come back at the end. But some of the other things that don't agree with that?
No, I don't agree with that at all. Like, I think the elderly couple is a very clear sort of indication of just sort of like the, like, either like parents or some sort of like parental sort of figures in their life, because you see them three times. At the very beginning at the sort of fever dance sort of contest that she wins. Yeah, the jitterbug. You see her. You see them again at the airport, and then you see them again at the very end scene when they haunt her right up until she kills them. She kills herself. So I think that they're very clearly a representation of, like, either sort of parental figures who, like, told her, sort of, you know, had realistic expectations of her not making it in Hollywood and wanted to basically, you know, tell her, no, just, you know, stay here. You know, you winning a jitterbug contest doesn't mean that you're going to be a Hollywood star. And they're basically, you know, in sort of the, in her fantasy, in her sort of fantasia, they are with her at the starting off point of that journey and are very, very happy. And that sort of the menacing smile that they give when they are away from Diane is, I think, a very clear hint to the audience that everything is not right within the scene.
Whatever form they're taking, they're the typical Lynchian demon figures. No,
I actually know, like, after, like, checking something, I'm feel actually a little bit stronger about this, because for example, you have the audition in the audition you have she was rehearsing with an actor named Woody, and Betty's character referred to him as Dad's best friend. Woody and Dad's best friend are references to a penis and Betty's abuser. In her dream, Betty takes control and flips. But the main thing is, to me, is that the Rita Hay is the whole Rita Hayworth reference with the character taking on the name Rita. Rita was sexually abused by her father, the actual Rita Hayworth. She was an incest victim and sexually abused by her father.
This is the thing about Lynch, though, man. I mean, they're so packed with these mysteries that people construct very elaborate explanations for things. But the fact of the matter is, you don't have to fucking go far in Hollywood to find someone who's sexually abused. Just throw a penny around on the strip.
Well, but there's also the fact that there's the Sylvia North story, which is probably a reference to the movie Sylvia, which the title character's name was Sylvia West, and the movie is about how she was raped by her stepfather.
And you get the fact that she stumbles out. I mean, you have a lot of Sunset Boulevard references. She's stumbling out in the beginning. She's stumbling out on the Sunset Boulevard. You have the old woman who shows up at her place, named like Louise or whatever. That's an old Jewish Hollywood starlet.
Yeah.
Who's a similar, type figure as those. And Anthony West thing was like Judy Lee or something.
Oh, and even like Desmond's car, like when she gets out and sees like the pearly gates of Paramount Pictures, like the car that's like in between those two gates. That's Norma Desmond's car from Sunset Boulevard.
Right.
Like it's very clearly reference to that.
And that's, I mean, what happens in Sunset Boulevard? I mean, do you have a woman who constructs an elaborate fantasy to cope with the fact that she is no longer a star?
Yeah. Oh, here's another reference as well. That painting of the young woman in the hallway, in its prominent number of scenes. That's a painting called Beatrice Cenci or Cenci. How do you pronounce the CE sound in Italian? Cenci, Cenci, Cenci. I don't know. Cenci. But Beatrice Cenci was a Roman noblewoman who was the victim of incest by her father, and she paid to have him killed.
I mean, again, I'm going to spoil Twin Peaks here. So if you haven't seen Twin Peaks, this is me spoiling it. But again, Twin Peaks has a very simple plot that there's a lot else going on in that. But just from a narrative perspective, the plot is in a small Northwest town, a young girl's troubled because she's been sexually abused by her father, and then she's murdered, and turns out she was murdered by her sexually abusive father. That's the plot of Twin Peaks.
What do you guys think is the reason that this is a theme that Lynch appears to come back to, and that he depicts in the very emotive way that he does on film?
I think he cares very deeply for the actresses that he works with. And he's very protective of them. I think it actually is genuinely like that simple. I think it's something that I'm sure he's, as anyone who works in Hollywood is very well aware of the nature of Hollywood.
Finish your point.
Oh, no. This is him, not so subtly saying that Hollywood is genuinely one of the most, if not the most evil place on earth. So.
Lynch strikes me as a guy, like, there are some guys that you see, like, where, like, oh, he'd be a great, like, if he's not a dad, he'd be a great dad. Like, he's just got a naturally kind of fatherly, patriarchal, in a good way, a patriarchal kind of presence. And considering that Eraserhead is, it really is about kind of like the anxiety of fatherhood in among its a number of its themes, I can definitely see that as him. Like, he's, when he started to interact with a lot of these actresses and seeing how they were clearly just so obviously abused by by these Jews in Hollywood, that this was him, his way of kind of dealing with those complex feelings of wanting to protect them, wanting to, like, to soothe their pain or take care of them in some sense, and kind of like the pain of not being able to do so.
I mean, I can't speculate as to why exactly this is a film or a theme that Lynch is preoccupied with, but I can say that it's in almost every single one of his movies. I mean, his final film, Inland Empire, love it or hate it, its subtitle is like a woman in trouble.
Yeah.
And
she's an actress, and she plays an actress. Yeah.
And it's these same recurring, these things overlap. And I think a lot of it's, I mean, Blue Velvet, you have why is Kyle MacLachlan drawn into the mysteries? Well, he's drawn into the mysteries because he sees a woman in trouble.
Yeah.
why does Nicolas Cage find himself, you know, on the run from demonic forces? Woman in trouble.
Yeah, you know, no, that makes a lot of sense. I guess that's for people to speculate on, but this is something that it does appear that he is fascinated or troubled by. I'm not exactly sure how one would want to interpret that, but
well, I think that's why his films are also so dark, so deeply, you know, dark, is that he shows this, you know, they're usually pretty and often innocent, and the world doesn't care at all. There is sometimes one character who does, and he's sort of the hero of the film. And oftentimes there isn't no such character, as in the case of Mulholland Drive.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also, I think, the device that he likes for, to what extent this is mystery shit, you know, mysticism. He uses the woman to draw you in as the viewer, just as the characters are drawn in. You're drawn into the mysteries by the woman. You know, you follow her down deeper and deeper into the depths.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I decided to Google if I did David Lynch anti-Semitic, if anything would pop up if they had ever accused him of it. But I did see an article. I didn't see anything pop up immediately, but I did see David Lynch reacts to Hollywood sexual harassment by evoking the Golden Rule. So it's interesting that they went immediately kind of to him to get a kind of like a statement or his views on the issue of this Hollywood sexual harassment, sexual abuse.
Yeah, I mean, well, it is interesting that in sort of, and I think we have sort of passed the moment of like Me Too specifically as you know, right this moment, the Democratic frontrunner has been accused of rape and no one cares anymore. So we've passed that sort of cultural touchstone. But I did always find it as sort of the sort of manufactured sort of aspects of like that whole sort of Me Too issue. Obviously, you know, let's not be I don't mean manufacturing.
I understand what you mean. What you mean basically is that this whole Me Too thing, like, is almost like a controlled opposition thing about a real issue that is a problem and is prevalent.
Not astroturfed is a much better word, and one that I was in fact looking for. But I always did find it strange that like Mulholland Drive was never really sort of discussed. Sort of within sort of that sort of cultural sphere. I've never seen like a Twitter blue check feminist like talk about Mulholland Drive. And of course, I mean, I guess that is a good thing because if anyone if any sort of group of people consistently gets David Lynch wrong, it is libshits. So I am sort of grateful for that, but at the same time, I mean, this is like when you talk about like a movie about sort of the disease at the heart or the diseased heart of Hollywood, like Mulholland Drive is like the immediate. Titus,
are you implying that the lib, that his soul is closed to Aryan mysticism?
Yes, I am. Else they wouldn't be a lib, my friend.
It's interesting when you think about contrasting, like, this came on the heels of Twin Peaks, and as I only just learned after watching The Return that connection that the Audrey character was going to be brought to LA. And that's the thing about Twin Peaks, is it's set in this quaint Northwest town that is, you know, lost a little bit to you know, what's contemporary. And so when a young girl dies in that town, everyone is affected by it. You know, that's the whole slow burn of the first episode or two. It's everyone, you know, it finds this tragic, and it's actually emotionally affecting people. Whereas you plop an innocent young girl into the setting of Los Angeles and you dump her body off of, you know, Sunset Boulevard or Mulholland Drive, no one cares.
Yeah, that's an interesting point, because as well, like, that David Lynch on that first episode of Twin Peaks affects so heavily, focuses so heavily on the effect of a girl being lost to a community, which is something that, you know, especially going into the 90s, is something that white America experienced quite a bit with the way that, like, this kind of like the slow decay of American civilization has more or less gone. And when you look at movies that are about, like, the death of a young girl, there's never this focus on, like, how that affects community. Like, that's, she's always kind of like this object for either revenge or kind of wallowing in, like, the film of, like, the kind of like the film language of death and the lurid kind of, like, there's like a lurid pornographic quality to it, the way that they invite you to gaze upon this morbidly, whereas Lynch wants to focus on, like, how does this actually affect people. I don't know, just an interesting thing that occurred to me. But I forgot where I was going to go with this.
Did you guys see the Twin Peaks: The Return?
Oh yeah,
I know Titus did.
Yeah. Oh, now I remember what I was going to say. But go ahead.
Well, did you see it? You saw it?
No, I haven't seen it.
Oh, okay.
Come on, Nick. You always ask me, "Have you seen X?" And you know the answer is always no.
Mm-hmm.
It's been pointed out that I'm the worst person to be doing a show about this stuff because I don't watch a lot of media.
Insufficiently cinephilic, Borzoi.
yes, this has been a,
it took me a while to watch it. I wasn't I mean, look, back in the day, I couldn't even finish the second season of Twin Peaks. I mean, I loved the first season. The second season of Twin Peaks was one of the most disappointing things I've ever seen.
I mean, for the uninitiated, the Disney Corporation,
well, the Black Lodge took over the production.
Yeah, exactly. And yeah. So,
yeah.
No, I mean, season two of Twin Peaks is...
What was it? It was CBS. Is Bob Iger back at CBS back then?
ABC, yeah.
ABC, was it?
Yeah, it's Disney, because it's a Disney, Disney-owned property. Yeah. That's even
funnier than that was on ABC and owned by Disney. I
thought CBS was at, Iger was at CBS back then.
You know what? Maybe it was CBS.
Yeah.
Okay, well, now I got to put my take on hold. No, original network is ABC. I just looked at it.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I don't know. I just,
which is even funnier then, because then, you know, like, it's, that's a, the network owned by Disney, and so you have this film about a young girl being killed. Never mind. I don't know. I guess I'm just trying to make an anti-Disney statement of the way that they, you know, they groom and rape young women.
Well, ABC has a, I mean, David Lynch has had ill luck with TV.
Why he's resorted to selling coffee beans.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, here's the question: Is David Lynch ever going to be able to work again in Hollywood after The Return, or is The Return the end?
Empire was already the end.
Yeah.
What happened in The Return? Like, what? Okay, maybe I just don't understand, like, where you guys are going with this. Like, what's in The Return that would, like, kill his career?
Well, no, I wouldn't say that it kills his career, but, like, it's there. Well, you just have to watch it.
That's right. You can't really describe.
Yeah.
Dang it.
No, that was, The Return was the last TV show that, like, I watched, like, traditionally, like, every day, every Saturday or Friday, whenever it aired, I'd watch it, for, you know, the time it was out. Yeah, it was an incredible experience, to say the least.
What I was going to say, Titus, that I had forgotten is that when you were talking about shitlibs, like, that you're happy that they haven't, you know, they haven't, like, rediscovered this film. What that made me think of, in because of their twisted priorities, is that, and I'm gonna trigger you with this, but when they once again found out about Stanley Kubrick's directing technique on The Shining and Shelley Duvall,
yeah,
and they tried to cancel Kubrick over over making Shelley Duvall do that same take 100 times.
Yeah, it's just very, I mean, I can't, like, I don't have any sort of emotional, like, my, like, emotional reservoir that I've built up. Like, I don't spend any of it on these people. Like, they are, like, I have sort of emotionally unpersoned them all.
They're just bags of dust.
Yeah, and like, the sort of the libshit sort of colloquial understanding of David Lynch, or sort of their colloquial sort of appreciation for David Lynch, is entirely an exercise in, like, projection, because you'll have sort of their sort of most basic understanding of, and it's usually either Twin Peaks or Blue Velvet in which they would say something like this, where it's like, yeah, you know, America, you know, David Lynch is saying that, like, America is this, like, idyllic place, but, like, deep down, man, like, everyone's, like, you know, shitty and horrible, and that's what he's trying to say. And it's like, that's the exact opposite of what David Lynch is saying. You only say that because you're also a shitty and horrible person. And they don't have, again, the sort of introspection to sort of deal with that reality. But I'm starting to get, I feel like my voice getting heated. So, like, that emotional reservoir is actually, I'm starting to spend it. So I'm actually going to...
I did say I was going to
calm down for a brief moment. But that is the sort of contemporary sort of normie shithead understanding of Lynch, is that he's trying to convey something that they want to believe is true. And the opposite, in fact, is what David Lynch is saying. And this actually, I'm actually going to segue this into something that I sort of set aside earlier in, and that is the idea that David Lynch's films are open to interpretation. I genuinely believe that is utterly bullshit. If you ever look at whatever David Lynch, like, talks about, sort of the opaqueness of meaning with his films, he always says that there is something that he is trying to convey. So you can sort of extrapolate that into saying that there is a objective truth that these films are attempting to portray to the audience. Like Blue Velvet and Mulholland Drive and everything else, you can say that they could mean whatever. And that may be true to you, but it isn't true to the film. There is an objective truth that in Lynch's work. And that's something that I'm very, very sort of passionate in sort of explaining to people, because it does sort of boil into, like, you know, this is sort of the problem with post-war culture, in that the idea of subjectivity, like, subjectivity has been fetishized to a ludicrous degree. There are objective truths. We're on the distant right. We believe in objective reality. We believe in objective truth. And David Lynch, and this is sort of the grand irony of David Lynch and of sort of the Lynchian sort of frame of artistic endeavor, is that, yes, it is bizarre. Yes, things are out of place. Yes, the narrative is strange and opaque. But despite all of that, there is an objective meaning behind it, and that I do think is true to sort of David Lynch's sort of sense of humor, in that, like, I'm going to give you madness on the screen, but it does mean one very specific thing. I think that's funny.
That's something that's very near and dear to my heart, because go ahead.
Well, you go ahead, Burz. I disagree somewhat, but we will discuss. Maybe
maybe this will bridge it for you, because I do support elements of the, like, death of the author thesis. Like, for example, example that I always go with is John Carpenter doing They Live. I 100% believe John Carpenter when he says, I made a movie about Republicans. I 100% believe that's what he believes. You made a movie about Jews, John. Like, you may not have realized that you made a movie about Jews. Like, that's absolutely real. You can take those elements to it, but I 100% agree with you, Titus, is that you cannot remove the artist completely from the art. And in fact, like, you, if you want to have different interpretations, you can do that, but you have to 100% incorporate the author and artist's intent into that and the way that they constructed it, especially if they know what they're doing.
Oh, and by the way, like, I should add as an addendum, like, I'm all in favor of, like, the death of the artist for, like, artists whose politics I don't agree with. Like, I'm not ideological in terms of sort of film or literary theory, but, like, I do impart sort of that a greater level of respect for artists who have my politics, obviously, because, you know, they're objectively right. So
is that where you were kind of going with it, Nick, or did you have a different kind of take on that?
So I would agree that Lynch is a very deliberate filmmaker. There's no doubt about that. As to whether or not things have specific meanings, sort of. I would say, again, he's sort of like a wizard, and what he's doing is leading the viewer into an initiation into the mysteries. Yeah. Namely, ultimately, behind life is a great mystery. It's not something that can be explained away. You know, there is a mystery. It's the mystery of the waters beneath everything. And you could ask, for example, why a blue rose? Well, it's not a red rose. It's not a white rose. It's a blue rose. Why? Well, I don't know. David, why is it a blue rose? Will David tell you why it's a blue rose? I don't think so. But a lot of the time, what he's trying to get you to do is see meanings that aren't there and find that they actually are there, or throw out meanings you thought were there, namely that, you know, things aren't what they seem. The owls are not what they seem.
I found what you said about his movies being about the mystery of life interesting. Did you think? Would you describe Lynch as a vitalist filmmaker, that there's a quality of vitalism to his films?
Well, I would say, so in Twin Peaks, for example, you have some characters who are closer, the struggle on light and dark, right, that you have going on there with the White Lodge and the Black Lodge. You have the characters in the small Pacific Northwest town who are more plugged into the mysteries, right? You have the Don Davis character, or the Red Engine character, or Kyle MacLachlan's character. Whereas in Hollywood, you have it. Mulholland Drive is basically a film entirely about the Black Lodge, where, you know, you're still looking at the same mystery. There's an ultimate fundamental unity to the cosmos. It's not, there are not two worlds. There are two entrances into the world beyond, or into the mysteries, namely the entrance through the dark and the entrance through the light. And Hollywood is the entrance through the dark that takes your soul. And Mulholland Drive is a film absolutely with no light.
Yes.
Interesting. Can you elaborate on that a bit? What do you mean, like, it's a film of no light?
Well, there's no contravailing force to the darkness.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm. Yeah, that's the point. Hollywood is all consuming.
His Hollywood trilogy is the exact same way. Like Lost Highway, no protagonist. Yeah, like Lost Highway, everyone's a villain. And Inland Empire, it's the same thing. It's also just equally void of evil.
This is why Wild at Heart is my favorite, is because then you have my favorite actor, Nicolas Cage, playing like the quintessential American hero, anti-hero, you know, who's basically calling everyone a faggot, who's
now it makes so much more sense.
Yeah, it's that's why it's like, I love Lynch, and that movie to me is the most, it's also the one that's most pleasant to go back to because there's something good to it. Whereas Mulholland Drive, it's a fantastic film, but it's a difficult film to watch.
And that might be why shitlibs haven't, like, returned to this film as much, if at all, because it's a troubling thing to watch. And because it affects you on that deep emotive level. And these are not like, when I think of the way that a shit lib approaches emotions, like, it's got a performative aspect to it. It's entirely
performative at this point. I'm at the point of thinking that these people don't feel anything at all.
Yeah.
It's been entirely artificial.
Yeah, they have an inherent sociopathic quality to them. So they don't know how to emote in a natural way or at all. And so they look at the way, and because this is why film so much informs like their worldviews, and so they have to take the language and emotions of film, and they try to perform that fact. Why it's why their film references are always film, and not just like reference. Like, hey, I made a reference to this thing. Like, my entire ideology and worldview is constructed by these things. Whereas people like right wingers, people who are just normal. I'm just gonna say normal people, because that's what it is. Fundamentally comes down to normal people. Like, they have a healthy understanding of emotions, like, and how to have multiple different ones and how to handle even the most troubling emotions. So when you have this traumatic emotive expression that David Lynch has, like, it bothers us. But we can deal with that bothering us, and we can process that, we can analyze that, we can deal with it. I wouldn't be surprised if that's something they're not very good at dealing with, if at all.
I mean, he's a man of great compassion. He did, after all, make Elephant Man.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There is no doubt about that. And he's so much
another film about abuse
that he became obsessed with his own fictional heroine. I mean, that's what I was going to say. That's the reason I asked about The Return. Which I guess I'm going to spoil this as well.
Just do it. If you listen to the pause button, you don't know we're going to spoil everything at this point. I don't know
what
to tell you.
Well, I say these though too, because I love all of these films, so I would encourage people to watch them and not have me spoil them. But I mean, after all of these years, I mean, the reason that Fire Walk With Me got made was that after Bob Iger shut it down, he wanted to revisit the character of Laura Palmer specifically. Yeah. And then after, what is it, 20 some years, almost 30 years, he wants to revisit the character of Laura Palmer again. And his protagonist, Agent Cooper, he has to emerge from the Black Lodge to find Laura after, you know, 20 some years that have passed in this world. Mm-hmm. So he cares. Like, this is... There is, as Titus started by saying, and he's right, there's a lot of heart to this. It's not just like a fantastical horror show.
Yeah, these aren't people who are just props to him. These are people
who
he wants to check up on. And it's well-being he cares about.
And despite sort of the violence and sort of the luridness that's being portrayed, it isn't done from a position of like malice or exploitation. It's actually from the exact opposite. It's showing evil in its like sort of starkest way possible. And in terms of the Twin Peaks and Mulholland Drive connection, I did want to bring this up. I don't know if you guys ever noticed, but in Club Silencio, sort of the final grandiose scene of Diane's fantasy, you know who else is seated in that theater? Laura Palmer and Ronette Polanski.
Yeah,
like the actresses are there sitting right behind him.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah. I never knew that. Yeah. But that's what I said earlier too, is he brings all his people, and it's not just the women, you know, he brings everybody back in. His movies all kind of flow into each other in that way.
How would you interpret the whole thing about Club Silencio? What is Club Silencio exactly in this?
Well, it's the best scene in the movie.
Yes.
Well, right.
It is the best. Well, okay. So it does like David Lynch at his, we're operating at his like highest level, right? It does numerous things at the same time. Like, Club Silencio is a sort of explanation to the audience.
It's the revelation of the method.
Yes. It's the to go back to Nick's sort of use of magician terms. It's the prestige, right?
Yeah,
it's,
that's what I was looking for earlier. By the way, Titus. Yeah.
But yeah, so it does numerous things at the same time, right? So it's the revelation to sort of it's Diane's subconsciousness trying to tell her that what she's been experiencing throughout the entire movie has been a fantasy. But it's also David Lynch speaking to the audience of the nature of not only of dreams, but the nature
of the dream makers.
of the dream makers and the nature of film itself. Film is an art form itself.
Yes.
That's the artificiality of it all. Yeah.
Yeah. But it's also, but in being illusion, it's also real.
Yes. And then,
so there's multiple layers of that reality where you have, you know, it's, there is no band, you know, it's, well, there's also Rebecca Del Rio is really standing on the stage. However, what she had to offer, whatever was beautiful about her, and in her case, it was her voice more than anything, and still is great. I mean, he used her again in The Return. You know, they took that from her. Yeah. They took what she had that was beautiful, and they created something with that, depriving her of her essence. And then she drops, presumably dead or what have you, because she's been used up.
Mm-hmm. And it's right when they're at outside at 2 o'clock in the morning trying to get a taxi. There, when they're trying to hail it, there is a sign that to the right of them that says, you're drawn to look at them in the background, but in the foreground you see a sign on a streetlight pole that says Hollywood is hell. And you could, you know, one interpretation of this, one interpretation of this whole scene is like this is her dealing with the trauma of death.
Well, if, through a future's past, magician longs to see.
Yep. Yeah.
I mean, I think that's his treatment of film overall. He said it is a magical device. And in the case of Hollywood, you know, I think he recognizes that it is used largely for evil. You know, it's used to create an image of something that is not the reality and to obscure the reality that's actually there, which is systemic abuse and tragedy, human suffering, predatory interdimensional demons, basically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's also, I'm trying to think here. There's also like a tarot on the whole idea of mysticism. There's also a tarot card aspect to this because, you know, you have the magician within the scene, but you also have the blue light, the blue lightning and the thunder. That's I believe it's on the Rider-Waite tarot. The tower has lightning on it as well. Mm. Which. I don't know. Yeah, I mean, oh, here we go. Somebody compiled a lot of the interpretations of the tower, because I can't remember what that stuff was off the top of my head. There was a time when I was really interested in the symbolism of the major arcana of the tarot, and I used to know it a lot better, but I don't anymore. You got let's see here, the number. Oh, this is, and it's also about the number 16. Number 16 comes up repeatedly in Mulholland Drive, and that's the number on the card, on tarot. Some of the themes, like when the card is drawn, whether it's reversed or upright, which again, like, there's another theme right there of like you have the reversal within this film between the reality and the fantasy or the dream. You got themes of humiliation, bankruptcy, suicide, self-delusion, the inner world being turned upside down, life-changing events, building castles in sand, breaking out of self-created prisons. Like, these are a number of themes that you can use within the major arcana of the tower card that you can see applied in this film. Hmm. But yeah, that's esoteric. That's hard to kind of like delve into esotericism unless you fully know, kind of like have a full understanding of it. It's hard to kind of just like,
well, it's certainly, again, like everything is intentional with David Lynch, because you know, Twin Peaks is an exploration of the esoteric. So it calls to reason. I never picked up on that. And I actually, to be perfectly honest, I don't think I've really picked up on anything else that was like explicitly esoteric in his other films. Like, save for like Twin Peaks, which is very much sort of like on the nose, hints at some things. But yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah, it's one of those things, I think, where unless like you are the kind of person that like wants to look for esoteric, I guess, like, that's kind of like the nature of the esoteric. Like, it only calls to those who want to like delve into those specific memories. So those specific meanings. So like if it's not because I know you have some interest in the esoteric, but if it's like not the specific kind of esoteric you're interested in, it may not it's just one of those things. Like esotericism kind of self-selects. It's like which is kind of a weird paradox when you think about it, but I guess it's the nature of it.
I would say the symbols that he uses, they're not always so important in of themselves, and this is true about the esoteric as well, sometimes to a degree. I mean, that is a rabbit hole. But speaking just of Lynch, the point is largely that they are to direct you beyond it, thing itself.
Yeah. Do you think it might be meant to call it as a way of signaling to draw yourself in and explore what the esoteric meaning of Hollywood itself, because Hollywood obscures and hides so many things.
Take one of the most recurring symbols that he uses, the curtain, right? It's a curtain. It's a veil separating places, separating worlds. And used extensively in Twin Peaks, but in Mulholland Drive, it's in the room where the arch Jew demon is sitting.
Also in Club Silencio.
And in Club Silencio, yeah.
And then you kind of have the theme, you can see the theme of the curtain call, where you have the performers walk out to be recognized their dual realities acknowledged.
It's also like the red curtain also, again.
The red curtain, the red bed sheet, the red bed sheet where,
go ahead. No, but also like with the red curtain, that red curtain specifically is like old time cinema, where the movie the curtains will lift and the fantasy will play.
I actually I'll tell you guys, I actually bought my shower curtain is the red and white chevron pattern.
Nice.
I couldn't help it.
Interesting. I'm just kind of looking through my notes. Like, I mean, I wrote down some kind of goofy notes where it's just like I'm pointing out things in the movie without elaborating on it, because it's basically kind of self-explanatory. It's just like in the movies, we'll pretend to be someone else. I mean, I guess that's like that's the kind of material in this movie that's probably a bit more obvious in its themes of persona.
It's also the nature of dreams too, because, and I forget who, forget where I read this from, but I read that, everyone that we meet in our dream is like, it is a face that we have seen before.
Yes.
Like in our sort of like, the way our unconscious works is that our unconscious doesn't have sort of the sort of drive to create sort of like fictional faces. So it imparts things that we've already witnessed, and it just sort of rearranges them, which is, again, the nature of.
Furthermore, what if dreams are exactly that, but also are a way to experience time and existence in a nonlinear manner?
Yes. Yes.
Which is a big theme. I mean, that's how in Twin Peaks, he's able to solve a mystery or through dreams.
Yeah.
And there's also the powerful effect that reality has on dreams itself and the reality that our dreams kind of become. One of the most fascinating things that I discovered when I was learning about the effects that technology has on us. And I know technology and industry is a theme that Lynch has explored before. I don't think that's probably explored as strongly in this specific film, but something that
part of Twin Peaks, if not the largest part of Twin Peaks.
Something that really stuck with me is that when television was first invented and it was black and white, the people who grew up in that time period, who their experience with television was largely or entirely black and white, reported dreaming in black and white.
In black and white?
Yeah, and I, because like that, I first learned about that from Persona 5. Some people are probably gonna know like where I got that from. That when I first saw that in Persona 5, like I thought, I was like, that's like bullshit. And it's like, there's no way, like that, there's no way that that was, that's true. And it's a little bit of a exaggeration based off of a study that there were people, like a minority of people, were so deeply affected by black and white television that they exclusively dreamed in black and white. But I mean, that's something this theme of the power that our experienced reality, which includes watching television, watching movies, that the experience that this has on our dreams is definitely something that Lynch is aware of and thinks about and expresses in his films.
I think I would add too, as to the question of meaning, Lynch is very, he's much occupied with the absurd quality of life, and that's the things that you don't ask too much for an explanation behind. You accept that they're facts of reality, and in a certain way I think that's where you see his humor, and it's almost a defense, I guess, against, you may say, I don't know, the dark occult forces of the world. I mean, that's why the Kyle MacLachlan's character in Twin Peaks, he is able to navigate, you know, this maze, is because he's somebody who's comfortable with the absurd. You know, it's not just like, oh, Lynch is a quirky guy. There's something more to that. I mean, that's why he's able to, I mean, that's kind of the joke. It's like, he's a Fed. He's supposed to be a G-man, but he's going to ask this lady's log for information.
Mm-hmm.
And he's going to be comfortable doing it. You know, it allows you, when I guess, I know there's an appropriate Alice in Wonderland quote, but it's escaping me. It, you know, it's a way of being grounded when there is no longer any further ground.
I don't know. I don't really have anything to add to that. Oh, here we go. Dream. Like, I was just looking. I'm just looking at this dream and reality aspect of this. People have been really kind of obsessed with the theme in this. There's a number of theories that people have promulgated. Camilla's not dead. Camilla's love was just an illusion. It's a replay of Diane's sexual abuse. The old couple represent Adam and Camilla. Diane's suicide is not real. Diane projecting herself as Rita. Schizophrenia. Battle of superego and id. Bribery theory.
I find these takes to be very Reddit, to be honest.
Yeah,
with you.
To be perfectly honest. Like,
yeah.
Diane kills herself. Like, she dies at the end of this movie. Okay. Like,
well, that's, know. I guess that's something I would love to just talk about
Titus,
right now briefly.
Titus, she kills herself at the beginning of the movie.
Yes.
One of the worst things that the Redification of our culture and Reddit itself have done is, because people don't understand film and they're not able to appreciate, I think, like kind of like the thematic aspects of film, the language of film,
the spiritual aspect,
exactly. Yeah. So they have to construct, like, they have to look for novelty takes on films constantly. One of the things I hate the most. Like this kind of got brought up on the Thing episode of like people trying to like have this novelty take on the Thing and all that. It's like, that's like, if that's what you're looking for films to do, like that, like for like a weird kind of mystery that's embedded in it, you're not appreciating the film for what it is and what the experience is trying to convey.
Well, yeah, cinema watching has been gamified. Like that really,
exactly,
is like,
yes,
what like sort of the Reddit takes have done, because you're not watching a movie to have any sort of like either sort of understanding of yourself or of the wider world or sort of view some sort of like emotional, you know, elements that you may be uncomfortable with. There is no sort of mental or spiritual growth. You're doing it to get fucking upvotes.
Yeah,
it's fucking hideous.
Film Theory, which is that channel, Film Theory ruined an entire generation of film watchers.
Yeah, unironically, yeah.
Yeah, no, I believe that without it, with a hint of irony. Yeah, the film theorists, that's what they're called. But yeah, they do the series called Film Theory that is, I'm trying to find like a good example, like that would be like, oh, here we go. Film Theory, how Harry Potter isn't the chosen one. Film Theory, why Scar is the rightful king. Film Theory, Aladdin is yeah, shit like that. Oh, here we go. Film Theory, Strux's donkey was secretly a human. Like, this is what Reddit has done.
It's like, you're a 30-year-old man reviewing The Lion King for clicks. Well done. You're a success in life.
These are people who are uncomfortable with the fact that there is a mystery to life.
Yes.
They're uncomfortable with mysteries. And they need total explanations.
The sublime irony of a YouTuber called Film Theory. What is the likelihood that he's ever watched a Ingmar Bergman film?
Exactly.
You know.
I'm just... You'll learn more from watching just a couple of Ingmar Bergman films than you will from basically the entire oeuvre whatever of whatever these guys are watching.
You can learn more in about humanity in one Bergman film than like getting a like bachelor's degree in like philosophy from your local university, like unironically. That's I genuinely believe that.
Yes. Oh, definitely. The this is kind of like that whole core of like the liberal psychology as well. That's the reason why liberalism became the default ideology through a power process where it was applied across the world. But the reason why it was so palatable was because it allows you to be an NPC, basically. It allows you to basically be unreflective and unemotive and unvitalistic in your life, and it's an easy thing for people to do and for people to come, and it creates these bizarre reactions as well, because I've talked about this before as well, but Pentti Lingola has that famous quote about like what to do when the ship sinks and you only have one lifeboat. You know, people who hate life are going to try and pile as many people on until it sinks, while the person who loves respects life and wants life to prevail is going to take the axe and begin severing hands. And that's always been interpreted by liberals as a very ghoulish quote. And in fact, Lingola himself has wrote about the reaction he himself got on that quote from Frederick George von Wright or something, who was the liberal philosopher who inherited Ludwig Wittgenstein's Cambridge philosophical chair. And he wrote to Lincola about that quote, and his exact reaction was like he was so horrified by the idea of it that he'd rather just all of humanity sink than to even have to like make a hard choice or to meditate on the difficulties of having to like make choices in life.
That's liberalism right there.
What do you guys think? Do you think that a man's attitude largely determines the way that his life will turn out?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, it's increasingly turning out that way.
And I'm not being glib about it.
Yeah, and it can extend to when a man watches a film.
Yes.
No.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, I think Lynch makes it difficult for these people, and that's satisfying to me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's not. I actually had written this down as well. One of my notes, like one of my really bad notes on this, but like probably the most insightful note I made for myself on this is, let's see here, the movie unsettles me like a dream. Like Hollywood is a bad dream. Like that, but the key thing there, like the movie was first I saw this, like I had never, so I knew about this movie and I think I had seen a couple of clips before, but I had never watched this movie in its entirety until I was asked to do this episode, and it was a very, very unsettling experience. That's actually one of the benefits, I think, of me being such a bad cinephile about some of this stuff, is I experienced the stuff for the first time, and so you kind of get a fresh neophyte's look at it. This movie was so deeply unsettling to me and troubling to me, like I had to go outside and have a smoke afterwards.
Yeah. No, it's a movie that sticks with you, for certain. It hits some pretty troubling nerves very, very well.
And the ability to experience that and then process it and deal with it, fundamentally being able to deal with it, is something that liberalism doesn't allow people or engenders that, or engineers that out of them.
Yeah, it incentivizes the exact opposite for certain.
Yeah, yeah, definitely incentivizes a very performative aspect. Like the thing about like the reaction they would have to this is like, oh, I got to get on Twitter and talk about how horrible this movie made me feel, or you know, like trying to find some kind of novelty take on it, or trying to like talk about like, oh, how horrible this movie is about abuse and all that. It's like, but there's no content to what you're actually saying because you're not able to deal with what you saw.
Nope. Yeah, there's no internalizing. There's no internalizing mechanism anymore. But yeah,
which is actually the funny thing is like that was the real origin of the MPC meme. Like, because that meme, which I had a small hand in kind of helping to like push some of the like actually you and I had a small hand in all of that because of that famous like inner monologue stuff we were looking into Titus. Like you and I had a small hand in the creation of that. We didn't create the actual Wojaks or anything like that, but there was a like we were troubled by like if the philosophical consequences of like are there people who don't have an inner monologue and what does that mean exactly. And that's really what we were looking at, how the NPC meme was supposed to be expressed, is that there are people with no process for an actual inner life who just aren't able to like cope with life itself, the mysteries of life, as Nick put it.
Well, another thing is we haven't touched on is would make him anathema to the Jew, is that if you want to interpret his films or you want to avoid the mystical aspects of them and you just want to look at them psychologically, which is you're missing the whole picture. But if you were to do that, his films are very much non-Freudian. You know,
they're very Jungian. Yeah.
Yeah. They're the Jungian tradition, Jungian in the sense in particular that there are multiple selves contained within the individual and that they are equally valid. They're not, you know, one is not just pure illusion.
Yeah, that's I think that's a similar theme in Ingmar Bergman's films as well, that there's that aspect.
Oh yeah, Persona in particular.
Yeah, and well, that's exactly because like the idea of persona is something that's a very Jungian concept, and that's something that Lynch is definitely fascinated by. This is, would you guys say like this is one of his most like that this film might be one of his more larger meditations on the idea of persona, because like this aspect comes up again and again in the movie.
Lost Highway is like the sort of the turn in Lost Highway is equally extreme, I would say.
Yeah,
because the main character literally changes into another person, like a totally different person. So I think Lost Highway is probably a better exploration of that, but it's also less complex because Diane is evil because evil has happened unto her, right? So she is a victim as well as sort of an agent of malevolence.
What's in the box, Diane?
Exactly. Yeah. So that's Diane's is a far more complicated character than the main character of Lost Highway, who is just a murderer. but yeah, it's the idea of persona. I mean, Blue Velvet has aspects of that. I mean, again, like it goes back to like, you know, Frank Booth being the man in the mustache and also, you know, using a mask to get high. I mean, it's sort of, you know, in sort of the terms of masking and identity. There's elements there.
Paps, Blue Ribbon.
Yeah.
I didn't know that small town suburban America had psychopathic oxygen huffing gangsters.
Yeah, exactly. You would think, right? One in every town.
I recently
Wild at Heart. Does that have any? I think I've seen that movie maybe once or twice. So I don't know what it is.
They all have it to some extent.
Yeah,
I would say. I mean, Lynch very rarely uses one technique only once.
That's true. And you can on kind of these notions of Jungian psychology, you could see the because this is a movie about personas, and then you have that the hobo, which we haven't talked about at all. The hobo is the shadow intruding on the waking life.
Yeah, the hobo. Well, the hobo, I've always viewed as the sort of embodiment of metaphysical evil.
Yeah, it's Bob.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah. It's another, again, it's the interdimensional demon figure. Yeah. That it waits at the end of the line, you know, to scoop up the lost souls.
Behind the alley at Winkies.
Yeah, behind the Winkies, man. Yeah, I mean.
Yeah, that is actually like an interesting way of viewing how Lynch approaches the idea of like the face of evil, the idea of the interdimensional demon, the consumer. The entity that consumes lost souls, that draws people to their doom. Because in American media, in American art, there's a very stunted quality to it. Like when people think of often think of like the negative aspects of America, one common way people kind of think of it is like an emotionally stunted man child. There's an aspect, the darker aspects of the American culture can definitely embody that. So the way that he has this very quirky way that he, because like again, kind of going to the whole performative aspects of like liberalism and culture, like the idea of the interdimensional demon and evil has to be a very like over the top kind of caricature. But because Lynch works on a much more emotive level, he brings it down to this very American quality, this much more American quality of like, you know, like behind the alley at the Winkies, like that's, but this is something that's behind the diner. There's I'm having trouble kind of expressing this, but he's kind of trying to draw attention to the American aspects of this.
Well, he makes it accessible by like placing it in because like it's the same thing happens in Lost Highway, where the embodiment of metaphysical evil first shows up at a sort of at a house party in Los Angeles. He's just a person in the crowd, and it's the same thing with the hobo at the in the alley behind a diner. He's placing very real and very powerful forces in commonplace locations,
because that's where they are.
That's the
thing about it is that you know, there's again fundamental unity to existence, and that the gateway to the mysteries is behind the Winkies.
Yeah.
You know, it is. I will reveal the secret to your audience, Porze, but it is well known that the Arby's dumpster, you know, well, if you have a local Arby's and you're feeling brave and you want to investigate the Arby's dumpster, I'll say no more.
One of my favorite tweets you ever did was like that time you went on the camping trip and you tweeted about that, like you had like discovered like the dark secrets of America, and you listed off some of the stuff like esoteric UFO cults or in Bigfoots and the like. I can't remember the way that you exactly expressed it, but
you would be surprised. I mean, you would be surprised what you can find in certain parts of America. You know, there are in fact many strange mysteries. I can only say too much about that because I actually, in another life, I made that was part of a film project I was working on. But you know, it's and I knowing where Lynch comes from, you know, it's. If you've ever lived in a small town in the Pacific Northwest, Twin Peaks is very true to form. You know, you have characters, man. I mean, you got strange characters who, you know, they are a bit quirky and endearing in these little logging towns. And then there's also, you know, some strange stuff that's not so good. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's America for you, though. I mean, in Lynch's films, they are really America through a glass darkly.
I'm sure you have some thoughts on this, Nick. But yeah, what do you think about the bum being played by Bonnie Ahrens? Anything deliberate in that?
Who?
Bonnie Aarons. I mean, like, it's just like you look at her and it's like, yeah, that's like, look at, like, especially when you look at her nose, like, it's like, ooh, that's, yeah, quite violently Jewish.
Oh, yeah, I don't know anything. I don't know who that is. I did mention earlier, though, that the old woman who shows up, that was an old Hollywood Jewlette.
Oh, yeah, the one that plays Coco?
No, the one that Coco redirects from the door.
The robe. Oh. And yeah.
Got it. Interesting. I'm just looking at this, about the bub right here. Because like they were like they're looking at possible in interpretations the so like if you go like kind of like the oh that's right there have been like attempts to do because you said like on the idea of like Freud of Jungianism versus Freudianism and you said that this movie doesn't have Freudianism in it there are people who have actually attempted to force a Freudian
of course
interpretation.
There are.
They
that's point what Freudians
the,
do.
They point to the bum representing the id.
No. Yeah.
Which doesn't make any sense. To the no id. The it, you
no, no, no conception of metaphysical id? Evil.
The bum.
Oh, the bum. I see.
Just, which doesn't make wrong. Any sense if you think just about wrong. It.
No.
No. Yeah. In Lynch's work, there isn't, it's not that one reality is wholly unreal and another is. That's not quite right. I mean, there is layers of it as far as that, you know, she is avoiding confronting certain realities. There's no doubt about that.
She, like every other character, she exists within the fantasy and she exists outside of the fantasy.
And they inform each other.
She exists.
Yes. It was a fantasy that brought her to Los Angeles. Mm.
Yeah, and you have the because like that dream aspect you do have in the opening with when Rita is wandering into LA with amnesia, like she is this innocent, like by getting the amnesia she becomes this innocent creature and she's wandering into the absolute den of scum of evil that exists within the United States, and she's there to be preyed upon now, like she's this lost wandering lamb.
You have to also keep in mind that Diane never comes to any realizations.
Yes.
Okay. There isn't like Diane slowly piecing these things together because we're seeing this, you know, out of order, right?
Yeah.
There's no, in a lesser film. You would have like the person who's the crazy person, right? They're going to come to this epiphany moment and realize that they had dreamed up this fantasy. But the character of Diane never has that. It's the viewer that gets to see this. Diane doesn't come to a point where she's like, oh, I've been imagining something.
So basically the end of the movie is really the start of this. So then at the climax, when they're opening the safe, is that meant for us to like have the moment of realization of what this is when you piece it back together, or what then happens? And like if we're taking that as the opening of the box, as the kind of like the final moment of the actual timeline of this film, like what is that? Is that meant to remain a mystery?
What's in the box, Diane?
Yeah. What happens? Do you guys have any idea of what happens then at that moment?
Well, the box I've always viewed as reality because
it's... Why is the key blue, David? Why is the key blue?
Right. Well, the blue key and it answers like the question within the movie, which is what does it open? And the hitman laughs, right? So, but the box I've always viewed as...
Oh, and by the way, when he laughs, right. if you look to the left in the foreground, you can actually see a blue box in the background as well, a blue dumpster at Winkies. Right.
But yeah, so I've always viewed the box as reality in that it is the fake Diane, Betty, when she finally opens it, it sucks her back in.
It's contained something that's been pushed to the deeper recesses of the mind. You know, that's the box. Yes. And what opens the box? Well, a key opens the box. A blue key. And why is the key blue? Right. Why is the rose blue? I think Lynch also has his own, you know, I don't think it's a coincidence that, you know, he uses a blue rose in Twin Peaks and a blue key in Mulholland Drive. I don't think it's a coincidence, but I also would caution against reading too far into it, because then you miss it. It's very easy to miss the forest for the trees with Lynch. Mm-hmm. He gives you a lot of opportunities to do it.
There is would you possibly kind of view this, maybe, if I guess we want to, is it meant to then kind of remain a mystery of what essentially is? I mean, like, obviously that, you know, you have
it's the plot. I started with this. The plot is not a mystery. The plot is, yeah, woman goes to Hollywood, gets chewed up by the Jews, then does bad things she regrets.
Yep.
And then
kills herself.
Loses it. And then kills herself. That's the plot. There's no, you know, and then that's why those kinds of Reddit type explanations, but they're too consumed with the plot.
Yes.
You know, a magician doesn't reveal all of his secrets, and there's no reason that you should think that you're going to be able to crack, you know, his personal code, if you will.
Yeah, I think I'm just trying to, like, wring content out. Like, at that point, like, I think I'm just trying to.
Well, what matters?
Well, go ahead. You can.
Yeah, but what matters most about Lynch, is the essence and sort of the emotive qualities that are sort of present within it. And sort of like the little sort of technical, what does every little thing mean? It's what Nick said. It's the forest from the trees. It's sort of a forest from the trees mentality. You need to view it as sort of a completed sort of work, and just sort of let all of the individual parts sort of work together to create what you get out of it. And that's I've always sort of viewed certainly this film, but most of Lynch films, through that, because you do have, like, little idiosyncratic sort of moments and characters, and yes, like, they may have sort of like a wider what does the log lady mean in Twin Peaks, like, other than being a sweet, you know, mentally ill woman, you know, is there something more to that character? Like, well, yes, possibly, but she's not more important than what she is, if that makes any sense.
Well, yeah, you shouldn't be coming up with things that detract away from, like, say, like the trauma of death, which is much of, like, what the language of this film is about.
And the tragedy of, like, regret and just terrible life decisions. And this is not a fun, despite all of the individual sort of jokes and funny things that occur within this movie. This is a very, very, very sad film. Like, this movie will depress the hell out of you.
What were you gonna say, Nick?
Oh, well, just about the log lady. I mean, the log lady, it's quintessential Lynch. In order, like, in the original Twin Peaks, there's some, if you were to get, like, DVDs of Twin Peaks, there's two versions where one contains the log lady introductions and the other does not. Originally it aired with each episode with the log lady giving an introduction. I happen to love the log lady introductions, but some people do not. But what that is in order to, what he's doing is saying to you, look, behind here, I have many mysteries. And, you know, if you're going to be able to grapple with the mysteries, you have to accept that you're going to be introduced to them by a woman who talks to a log.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, if you can't get past that, you won't get any further. That's what the characters are grappling with. And that's why the Orpheus character of Agent Cooper is able to go into the underworld.
Yeah.
You know, because that's what it is. If you haven't seen, by the way, another film that I guarantee you has been hugely influential on Lynch. If you guys haven't seen it, I highly recommend John Cocteau's Orpheus. Because that's
part of a trilogy, isn't it? I haven't seen those.
It's not a trilogy per se. It is, but it's not like a sequential trilogy.
Okay.
It's like a thematic trilogy.
You can just watch Orpheus, and the others are good too. But Orpheus is the best, and Twin Peaks, that's really what it is. It's he uses similar techniques with illusion and mirrors, and there's it's I mean, he was a master in his own right. And despite being a queer, he was a sympathist with certain regimes in the 1930s.
Well, yeah, I mean, like, yeah, I guess just on that kind of, on that notion of the, you know, the homosexual as artist, there is, it, that is like the, because of the, of how out of step they are with life itself, it does lead to having a, it can often lead to having like a more artistic perspective on things. It's something that, that D.H. Lawrence, I know, has kind of meditated on, because he found that to be, he, the fact that he kept coming across that intrigued him on some level.
Yeah, I think that that's largely the magic. I mean, it pains me to try to dissect it too much, but that is, when you talk about like the women in trouble, these are the sort of the, I don't know how you pronounce it. It's Eurydice or Eurydice. I don't know how the Greeks would have you pronounce it.
You're probably Eurydice, maybe?
Eurydice. Yes. Well, she was, you know, the women in Lynch's works, they perform that role where they're swallowed by the underworld. And you have the character of Orpheus, who's, all, and you also have the viewer who are, you know, more often than not, you just have the viewer. In the case of Twin Peaks, you do have an actual protagonist. Mm. But the viewer is the Orpheus figure, and the woman being, you know, trapped and being drawn into the underworld is what draws the viewer into the, is what creates the initiation into the mysteries. And that's really what his films are, is that they are initiations into the mysteries.
Well, I guess we are initiated. But I don't know, do you guys have any, is there anything you guys want to specifically talk about this movie that we haven't already covered?
Well, I just want to, like, very, very briefly, because this is just something about David Lynch as a film director. His use of music is just profound.
We can't really talk about this movie without talking about that.
Yeah, and obviously, I think perhaps like the most sort of famous sort of David Lynch uses music scene is probably from Blue Velvet, where the sort of coked up sort of effeminate sadist lip syncs in Dreams by Roy Orbison. But the use of music in this film is superb, because it's the use of music, specifically in the fantasy element of sort of the sort of nightmare dream, is done with a level of and I want to focus on the scene where they're trying out actresses. So like there's a very clear element of artificiality because the actresses are lip syncing. And at the same time, and I forget the music is present within the film. I forget what it's called.
It's a very Phil Spector vibe too. It's interesting that they're making a movie that's set in that, you know, in that 50s Americana.
Was it the soundtrack?
Oh, diegetic music?
Diegetic music. Yeah. So like it's all like sort of diegetic, but it's at the same time like very clearly sort of artificial. It's just, I mean, again, like this sort of goes back to sort of one of my original points where it's just hard to, like, I can't quantify the scene where Diane or Betty sort of has that star-crossed lover scene with Adam. It's a very, very brief moment with the film, but it's shot so perfectly, and it is self-referential in that it's very much aware that sort of romantic movies have this shot, but he uses that shot to convey an entirely deeper meaning within the context of the film. And again, this is like this for people who haven't seen this film, like this, I'm speaking like fucking gibberish to you. And I sort of recognize that. But just Google, it's like Mulholland Drive, This is the Girl.
You could also, if you need the song for it, I've told every little star if you want to, if you need.
Yes. Yes. Song. Well, but I did, cause this is sort of the thing that I picked up on, when I was watching this film, for this review or sort of conversation, the scene when Diane walks onto the set as the girl is auditioning, is the original song is 16 Reasons Why I Love You. And what Lynch does in linking Diane seeing Adam for the first time while the actress is singing, and the lyrics within that moment, I want to just read out to you, and because I think it'll surprise you. So the lyrics are 9, snuggling in the car, 10, you wish upon a star, 11, whispering on the phone, 12, your kiss when we're alone. Like, those four lines correspond to the film itself. Snuggling in the car is in reference to Diane seeing Adam get seduced by Rita. Wish upon a star, the double meaning of star, wishing upon a star, wish upon a star, wishing to become a star, right? Whispering on the phone, the elements of them calling herself. Your kiss when we're alone, the fantasy element of sort of the, again, referencing the sort of the psychosexual element of, is Diane fantasizing about having sex with Rita because she's in love with herself, or is it a sort of lurid affair between two women, yada, yada. When I rewatched that scene, I was absolutely blown away by that sort of nugget that Lynch placed within that scene. I don't know if you guys want to talk about that or not. I
wouldn't say it's my favorite. My favorite's the Rebecca Del Rio performance, but
yes,
what I was most amused by music-wise when I rewatched it was this. Ironically, was the scene when Angelo Baldamente spits out the coffee, because as he stands up, that's when the music comes in, and it's very sinister.
Yes,
you know, they're all sitting in silence. He spits out the coffee, and then he stands up, and you know he Baldamente deserves the credit for that. He composed the score for that, and Blue Velvet, and Twin Peaks.
That comes highly recommended. It's a highly recommended espresso, sir.
Yeah. And, it, you know, I also goes without saying that Lynch is a huge coffee fanatic. I mean, that's his whole thing. He sells, like, coffee beans now. It's, you know, that's a recurring motif. I think it's worth, if you want to talk more about the music, you can do that. I was one thing I wanted to hit on, I guess, before we wrap up, is just comparing it to other films about Hollywood.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good topic.
Oh, was I muted? That was weird.
Nope.
I was wondering why Nick was talking over me. It's like, what the? Yeah, okay. I don't know how long I was muted for, but yeah, I got the song wrong. It was 16 Reasons Why.
Oh, I was going to mention
there's two songs in that. But yeah, go ahead. No
comments. I was going to mention also an aside. I happen to be a fan of, you know, with a caveat, but I am a fan of some of the old, like, Phil Spector type music. Because I've always felt it's sort of a Lynch. I have kind of a Lynchian feeling when I listen to it. Like you listen to the Ronettes or the Crystals or something like that. And I think Lynch has a similar feeling to what perhaps why he would use someone like Orbison. But listening to Phil Spector, what you have is, you know, you have these women who are, you know, they're pretty, they have pretty voices, what have you, and they sing these very, the lyrics in the songs are very superficial about the things in America that, you know, they just want to get married and find the guy who will love them forever. You know, meanwhile, lurking behind all of this is this, you know, sinister Jew figure, Phil Spector himself.
Yeah, who murdered an actress.
Yes, exactly. And there's something, you know, that's kind of the quality. If I had to, like, translate Lynch into music without Lynch's own music, which he is a musician, it would be that. It would be like listening to the Crystals or something, you know, where you had that feel. It's like that throwback 50s American feel where everything is really shiny and polished and pretty on the surface. But, you know, you can tell that something's not quite right.
Well, and I think the use of Lynch's repeated use of Orbison plays to that, not in the same sense that Roy Orbison was this insidious Phil Spector figure.
But no, he's not. There's a sense of
it's Americana, but there's, if you listen, you know, closely to Roy Orbison songs, they're usually very tragic and sad. So it's that sort of interesting meld again between the quaint and the terrifying, or the tragic.
Well, the reality is that life, I mean, as it is, that's where life happens. Life happens in the ordinary. That means that the tragic happens there. The mysterious, if the otherworldly is to be happening, that happens there too. Everything happens there. There is only ordinary life.
And something you've on the idea of tragedy in America, something you said to me, Nick, a year ago, that has stuck with me since then, and is actually what you got me into D.H. Lawrence. That was because we had this. You sent me those screenshots from his interpretive, from what he wrote about Moby Dick, and you went off about what, you know, what made America like America, and he said that you called us a country with like a country with a fundamentally tragic quality to it, but with a people without a sense of tragedy.
I think that is America.
Yeah.
In a nutshell.
Yeah.
Which like that has, because that feels so correct to me in the way that all three of us being Americans and having to be in this country. That is why, as well, like, it's a funny thing when you think about it, about how, when you think of countries that have cultural cringe, that people who can't stand being their own nationality, you don't see that inherent anti-quality as strong. I don't think anywhere else as strongly as you see how strongly Americans can become anti-American. And you can see this in two very funny different ways, with the liberal who is anti-American because like there exist people that don't share their view, you know, like the common people don't share their midwit views on politics and culture. Which is like that's just like that's a bunk way of looking at it. But then like there are people, you know, the normal people who end up becoming anti-American because like we have to grapple with this, with being an American, with this tragic, shattered sense of identity and purpose in the world that met a terrible conclusion, and then its corpse was co-opted by terrible people for terrible purposes.
The thing about tragedy, I mean, tragedy is predicated on context. I mean, real tragedy, you know, everyone dies, right? Everyone dies. But, you know, what happens when someone, there's always the counterfactual at play when you're dealing with someone great. When, you know, you talk about someone who they had great qualities, they were potentially going to be a great person, and then something happens and they're dead, you know, before their time. And what is, you know, the greatest sense of context is a sense of historical continuity. And this is what Americans lack. You know, the context in the scheme of history is understanding history. It's understanding where you come from. What are you a part of in the broader sense of it? You know, a nation can only be aware of people from looking at a country. You can only be aware of a tragedy of a country if you had an understanding of where it came from and where it could have gone.
Yeah.
Yeah, we started off talking about Roy Orbison. Roy Orbison, his career had basically gone away, and then he was given this second, and like his was a life marked by many tragedies, and he gets the second shot at stardom thanks to the Traveling Wilburys, and thanks to like a renewed interest in his music. And he dies of a heart attack at the age of 52 before he ever had a chance to capitalize on that and to do anything with that.
And I think that the liberal, I mean, to the liberal, it's like you put forward, you say that, you know, someone has died. Well, it's a tragedy. Well, how do you know it's a tragedy? You don't know what happened.
Yeah.
You know, if every death's a tragedy, then there are no tragedies.
Yeah. And that's the performative aspect of how they look at things. There's no context to their words. and to what they say about things. It's just
everything has to, everything is through the lens of social acceptability.
It's just air. That's all it is. It's just air. Well, do you guys have anything else on Mulholland Drive that you guys wanted to cover?
Just watch Mulholland Drive, folks.
Other films, but if you guys want to wrap it up, that's fine too. I was just going to throw a couple other movies about Hollywood out there.
Do it.
That's a good.
Okay. Well, I mean, obviously, he's bringing back some of the things that were going on with film noir. Obviously, we talked about Sunset Boulevard, and that I think film noir was America's great contribution to film, and it was very. Yeah. It was perfect. I mean, it wasn't exclusively American, but America perfected it.
Yeah, and it was a deep expression of America's shadow, which I think is very telling.
That's exactly correct, yeah. And Lynch is operating in that tradition. But what I would say is you really have to go back there to the beginning if you're going to find films that also approach when you're approaching Hollywood through the lens of film noir. That's probably the only place you're really going to find it.
Yes.
You ironically get it in places like Roman Polanski's, like Chinatown. There's, I have very mixed feelings about that movie because there's a lot that's very compelling about that film, but there's a lot that is poisonous in it, spiritually poisonous. But recent films, I talked to Titus about it a little bit. But I did see the new Tarantino movie, and these are two films that could not be more different.
Yes.
Quentin Tarantino's portraying, he's nostalgic for the fake Hollywood that never really did exist. Yeah. Hollywood, the illusory Hollywood. And he has that Hollywood triumph over the Mansons, right?
Yeah, the fan fiction quality of Quentin Tarantino's films, especially in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, was very striking to me.
Well, he's never going to address the fact that the Mansons were a product of that exact scene and that they were entangled with that exact scene. They were a creation of Hollywood, not some exogenous force that came in to ruin Sharon Tate's fucking day.
That's a good way of viewing it.
The only other film that I would put on the level of Mulholland Drive about Hollywood, and if you want to ever talk about this movie, it is worth talking about. I think it's David Cronenberg's A Map to the Stars.
I would love to do another Cronenberg film. Videodrome was one of my favorite movies to talk about in the show.
That is probably the single most woke film about Hollywood that I've ever seen. Even more so than Mulholland Drive.
You weren't going...
Say what?
Well, I'm surprised. I'd only add Barton Fink to movies about Hollywood.
I never got through Barton Fink.
Oh, really?
It's like the one Coen Brothers movie. I tried watching it like long, long time ago. I mean, long fucking time ago. And I turned it off maybe like 20 or 30 minutes into it. I just couldn't stand John Turturro. I mean, now I would probably give it its fair shake. But back then, I was just like, oh, "This is just annoying."
You're going to be pleasantly, Nick. You're going to need to watch that because I need to pick your brain on what you think.
Yeah, I'll bring you up on that, man. It's funny you say that. Not seen Barton Fink, I can say Map to the Stars, at least from the perspective of most normal people in the dissident right who aren't into weird mystical shit, like. Map to the Stars is as far as just a movie about Hollywood rot. There's a reason Cronenberg definitely won't get to make another film again. And Cronenberg is, of course, very Jewish, but he's always operated kind of outside of Hollywood. I mean, he's a Canadian Jew, and I think that was the first time he ever shot a movie in Hollywood. But that movie, that is interesting. Big recommend, Map to the Stars.
Okay. Wow, he hasn't. Man, you're not kidding. He hasn't done a movie since, and that was 6 years ago. He hasn't done a movie since Maps of the Stars.
No, there's no reason why. I won't spoil it. Just I'd watch that movie. I mean, people, you're gonna have to really struggle to read a bunch of anti-Semitism into David Lynch. I think it is non-Jewish that.
Yeah, it's not. Yeah, that's the that's its own reward.
It's its own reward. You know, and I don't just mean he's not a Jew. I mean, there's nothing spiritually Jewish in his in his films.
Yeah, but spiritually Aryan filmmaker.
But Map to the Stars, that is an anti-Semitic film.
I think, especially when we're talking about, like, I guess we could just briefly talk about this idea of spiritual Aryanism with David Lynch's films. The funny thing is that sometimes it's just enough for films that just not have certain qualities to take that on, because his films don't engage in this notion of critique, especially of like a social critique. These are films about
these are spiritual critiques. That's what they are.
Yeah, these are films about tragedies, about trauma, about emotions, and I think that's a very Aryan quality, is to not have specificity on certain things. Some things just are as they are, need to be experienced as such, and need to be processed as such. There's no, like, you're not supposed to, like, suddenly have this changed view, like this, like, critique view on things, a social critique, and like, okay, now it's time to, like, do X.
Did you guys ever see the famous Juju Abrams mystery box presentation?
No.
Wait, mystery box? What?
Yeah, I caught it. I don't know why I caught it when it came out, but for some reason I did. I think I was just upset about Lost. So I didn't get that far into Lost. Don't bully me too hard. But I remember when Lost came out in the first season, I was like, oh, that's interesting. Why is there a polar bear on this island? I want to know the answer. And then it didn't take much longer for me to be like, okay, fuck this show. And that's when I became a Nazi. Seriously, so like he did a TED talk, and the premise of the TED talk, because the reason I say it seems to be well known, because I've seen people mention this before. I think Red Letter Media might have mentioned it. It's probably where I've seen it elsewhere. But he did this presentation, and what it is it's just an explanation of his entire technique. And comes out on stage with this magic box that's unopened. And he's like, yeah, I was given this as a gift or whatever. It's been a year since I see it, so I may be getting some of it wrong, but I'm going to get the gist of it. And it's basically, this box is unopened. And I think what's really compelling about this box is, you know, we don't know what's in it. And he's talking it up for the whole presentation. And at the end of the presentation, he's like, hey, that's my presentation. Right. He doesn't open the box, is the point. The box has been sealed from when he got it as a kid, and he doesn't intend to open it. And the box, spiritually speaking, is empty when it comes to someone like him, because all he's doing is enticing you to want to know the answers to things. But that process doesn't reveal anything that's true. It's just a way to sucker your attention. Okay. Yes. And Lynch is the exact opposite of this. No, he doesn't always reveal to you the mystery, you know, in a very convenient way for you to understand, because that's not possible. That's not how life is. He's showing you the door to the mystery. Life, you know, there is, you're not going to be able to sort it all out in a coherent way, because it's beyond you. I mean, you are a finite being that you exist in the great sea of eternity. But with Juju Abrams, it's just a trick. Lynch isn't trying to trick you. He's trying to show you. Big difference.
Yeah, it's a great way of putting it, because like and death being being a common theme here, like what is after death? Well, that's the mystery for you to find out, but you should also be experiencing that mystery of life before you meet the mystery of death.
Well, and Naomi Watts is told to wake up after she's dead, right? When the ethereal cowboy figure, you know, opens the door, to her corpse, and he tells her to wake up.
That's right. We haven't talked about the cowboy at all in this. I don't know if you guys say anything you want to touch on with him.
He represents. He's a figure that represents. I mean, these pop up in Lynch's work, because everything else does. He's a figure that seems to have some idea of what the fuck's going on here.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
And by here, I mean in this world, in reality, right? He's somebody who knows something that we don't know.
Is there any significance to this cowboy, this quintessential American figure, being a tormentor to a Jewish director?
To a Jewish director?
Well, yeah. Well, that again, like that whole scene within the confines of the narrative of the film is, you know, like the visage of the cowboy again is sort of just Diane sort of unconscious. So you can probably extrapolate something, but in terms of like meaning, the meaning of the cowboy as a cowboy, that's just sort of her mind sort of coming up with some sort of sinister sort of intentions when she sort of glimpses him at the party for a brief moment. But no, like as sort of what Nick says, though, he is just sort of a one of those characters who is sort of imbued with.
Well, how many times do we see him again?
We see him three times. So we've been bad.
Yes.
Yes.
Is there, but I guess maybe this is veering on trying to, like, I guess, like, find specific meanings in the why of certain things. Is there any significance to him being specifically a cowboy, or is this just meant to be, like, this is a, there's, to just represent that this is an entity outside of the normal day-to-day experience?
Well, he's an entity, and at the same time, he's also just a guest at a party. He could be both. He could be one or the other. Who knows?
I mean, that the, you know, it's a specifically Hollywood form to take, yes. Right?
Yes, yes. That's, well, that was the other thing I was going to say there. Yeah. It just, I think that's the, this is me like driving kind of.
It's basically like Gary Cooper as the guardian of the underworld. You know.
Yeah. Mm. Which you might, like, again, like the whole idea of reality, and but especially media imposing itself on dreams, and dreams are also can be like an expression of that underworld aspect. You can have somebody's shining light into my house for some reason. Okay, that. Kind of creepy, like I'm getting very Lynchian vibes right now. But like, you can think, well, the point I'm trying to make is that the because like with the way that media has an impact on our dreams, and there's that underworld aspect, like that you have like this Gary Cooper-esque figure now being like the guardian of the underworld. That's the imposition of Hollywood images upon this unconscious psyche, and the, you know, with especially with dreams possibly being like a like an aspect of the expression of death, with how we may experience death because of the, of our passage through that, you know, these spheres of existence. Sorry about that. Like, I know, like, that was like, I wasn't able to click my thoughts because, like, why are they shining a light in my house right now? I'm fucking freaked out. No, you guys be quiet. It's creeping me out even more.
Have we revealed too much?
Yeah, I think so. You did make that joke about Bob Iger, Borzoi, so what do you want me to say? I mean, it's been
Wait. Bob?